Be conscious of the main factors that make any stress worse: repetition, unpredictability, and loss of control. In terms of going to the doctors or entering the hospital, repetition means that one stressful event follows another, such as undergoing several tests in a row or being asked the same question repeatedly by different people. Unpredictability means that you don't know what the doctor and the tests are going to reveal. Loss of control means that everything happening to you is dictated by outside forces. Let's face these factors one at a time. Repetition. In a medical environment, you can feel like an object being pushed along a conveyor belt, and at each stop, stress gets repeated. It is often unavoidable that a battery of tests must be run or that different people are going to ask you the same question. The worst repetition is probably having to return to the doctor or the hospital repeatedly for the same illness or treatment. One solution is to get off the conveyor belt mentally, which is done by returning to a sense of normal life even though you are in an alien place. Simple measures like chatting with other people, meditating, listening to an audiobook, doing some paperwork, or texting friends. In other words, everyday activity you associate with being in your comfort zone keep you in the normal world. Unpredictability. In the age of the internet, medical care doesn't have to be anywhere near as unpredictable and foreign as it used to be. There's a mountain of information about every aspect of illness and wellness, which millions of people now avail themselves of. The best use of this information is to wait until you know what's wrong with you. The worst use is to anxiously stab in the dark based on the symptoms you have or think you have. When you're at the doctor's or in the hospital, ask somebody to tell you what to expect when it comes to next steps. Waiting passively for an unpredictable event causes stress to mount. Dentists, who are acutely aware of their patients' anxiety in the chair, now regularly explain in advance the steps of the procedure, offering reassurance along the way. They also try to be realistic about the level of pain or discomfort to come, because sugarcoating this aspect of treatment builds up lack of trust, itself a form of stress. Loss of control. Handing yourself over to the ministrations of a stranger is an enormous stress, but it must be done in medical treatments. Knowing that you are going to be in such a situation, there are a number of ways to feel more in control. Be informed about your illness. Don't relinquish your opportunity to find out exactly what is wrong with you. This doesn't mean you should challenge your doctor. If you feel the need to inform your doctor about something you saw online, you aren't being confrontational, and most doctors are now used to well-informed patients. If the illness isn't temporary and minor, contact someone else who is going through the same diagnosis and treatment as you. This may involve a support group, of which many exist online, or simply talking to another patient in the waiting room or hospital. If you are facing a protracted illness, become part of a support group, either locally or online. Keep a journal of your health challenge and the progress you are making toward being healed. Seek emotional support from a friend or confidant who is empathic and who wants to help. In other words, don't lean upon someone who is merely putting up with you. Establish a personal bond with someone who is part of your care. Nurses and physicians' assistants are typically more accessible and have more time than doctors. Ideally, this bond should be based on something the two of you share: family, children, hobbies, outside interests, not simply your illness. Resist the temptation to suffer in silence and to go it alone. Isolation brings a false sense of control. What actually works is to maintain a normal life and social contacts as much as possible. Following these steps will go a long way to achieving the goal of patient advocacy, which is to serve the patient's best interests at all times. But there remains a difficult unknown, the possibility of a medical error. Studies have shown that adverse events are tied to factors you, as the patient, can't control, such as fatigue from the long hours and grueling routine that nurses, interns, and residents suffer from. In the rush of hospital routine, it's inevitable that some patients get shortchanged, overlooked, or treated incorrectly. Writing in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2009, Dr. Tate Schanefelt says, "Numerous global studies involving nearly every medical and surgical specialty indicate that approximately one of every three physicians is experiencing burnout at any given time." Dr. Dyke Drummond posted on the HappyMD, a website dedicated to alleviating physician burnout, that to understand the problem, think of drawing energy from a kind of bank account in three forms: physical energy, needed simply to keep going; emotional energy, for staying engaged and compassionate; and spiritual energy, necessary for remembering your purpose and why you do what you do as a physician. With every patient, there is a withdrawal from this energetic bank account. The trick is to keep enough in the account balance for the sake of the next patient. As a patient, the more informed and inquisitive you are, the better. If you know what should be happening, you're in a position to spot when something might be amiss. But the whole area of medical mistakes is a fraught one, and the last thing you want to do is to establish an adversarial relationship with the people who are there to care for you. Here's an outline of what to do and what to avoid. Do be involved in your own care. Do inform the doctor and nurses that you like to be involved. Do ask for extra information when you need it. Do ask for a questionable event, like a pill you aren't sure is the right one, to be checked with a doctor. Do tell somebody if you have gone out of your comfort zone. Do remain polite in all of the above. Do praise the doctor and nurses when it's called for. A show of gratitude doesn't go amiss. Don't act hostile, suspicious, or demanding. Don't challenge the competency of doctors and nurses. Don't nag or whine, no matter how anxious you are. Reserve these feelings for someone in your family, a friend, or a member of a support group. Don't pretend you know as much or more than the people who are treating you. Don't, when hospitalized, repeatedly press the call button or run to the nurse's station. Trust their routine. Realize that the main reason patients call a nurse is more out of anxiety than out of real need. Don't play the part of a victim. Show your caregivers that you are maintaining a normal sense of security, control, and good cheer, even under trying circumstances. Probably the most important finding about medical mistakes is that they are frequently caused by lack of communication. The breakdown mostly occurs between doctors and other medical staff as orders get passed along that are confusing, impatiently, or poorly stated, or otherwise lost in translation. As before, if you are well informed about your illness and treatment, you are in the best position to spot miscommunication. But to be realistic, this isn't an area where patients can do very much, and the medical profession has proved very reluctant to deal with the problem or even to recognize how serious it has become. Social categories matter here. Medical errors are the most likely to occur under conditions in which some groups are already disadvantaged. If you're elderly, poor, have less education, or belong to a racial minority, you aren't in the same position as someone who is younger, white, highly educated, and well-to-do. To no one's surprise, privilege has its privileges. But even so, each of us should take responsibility for what a patient can actually do to minimize miscommunication, which means being clear about how you describe your symptoms, stating your expectations in a realistic way. Do you want relief from pain, a cure, some signs of progress, a reassurance that the worst isn't going to happen to you? Patients have different expectations, and you need to be clear about what yours are, so that the doctor and other caregivers know. Speak up when you don't understand something about your condition. Ask about side effects of the drugs prescribed to you. Don't be afraid to inform someone if you didn't get answers to your questions. We've gone into detail on this topic because it stands in for something bigger than going to the doctor's office. When you become an advocate for yourself, you are being conscious instead of unconscious. You are valuing self-care at least as much as care from someone else. And in this attitude of self-care, you are being a healer. The patient advocacy movement arouses suspicion among doctors because it overturns the routine of patient care that puts the doctor completely in charge. Change is likely to come slowly, with organized resistance on the other side. Likewise, if you tell a doctor that you are a healer, his reaction isn't likely to be positive. He'd assume more likely than not that you are usurping his role. But we hope you believe after reading this far that no such challenge is being mounted. Our bodies already make us self-healers. Our conscious and unconscious choices determine whether we are helping or harming the healing response. The most basic choice of all is to be mindful instead of mindless. Nothing about this decision represents an attack on the medical profession. If you get involved in your own care, and a doctor or caregiver acts offended, they're committing a medical mistake already. Good doctors welcome patients who are not only involved, but show every sign of both self-reliance and trust in the doctor. The two attitudes aren't mutually exclusive, because in the end, doctors and patients are joined in the same activity, promoting the healing response as best they can. 8. The hidden power of beliefs.
In the steady progress of artificial intelligence, computers will never acquire one of the leading features of human intelligence, belief. A computer's reality is entirely based on facts that can be turned into the digital language of ones and zeros. If cold calculation represents a better mode of thinking than our messy mix of reason and emotion, even that is an assumption that AI, artificial intelligence, champions believe in and skeptics don't. Belief makes us more human. No other creature exhibits this quality of mind. But how beliefs actually work is still a mystery. Which of the following sayings is truer? I'll believe it when I see it. Or, you'll see it when you believe it. Neither one. Because despite the fact that they are opposites, each statement is a half-truth at best. Every physician in practice has experienced the phenomenon of patients who die from their diagnosis. This refers to how hearing bad news can be so traumatic, a patient quickly declines even though the underlying condition may be treatable, or at the very least, allow for months and years of survival. Seeing isn't believing in these cases. Two people diagnosed with lung cancer can be shown x-rays that are essentially identical, and yet their survival can't be predicted, nor would an oncologist expect it to be the same for both of them. There's an old medical school joke about the woman who goes to the doctor for her annual checkup and tells him that she is afraid She has cancer. He puts her through a battery of tests and informs her that it's good news. She's completely healthy with no signs of cancer. She returns the next year and again tells the doctor she thinks she has cancer. And once more, the tests reveal no signs of malignancy. This goes on for decades. Finally, the time comes when the woman is 75 that the doctor says, "I'm sorry to tell you this, but you have cancer." "I told you so," the woman exclaims in triumph. How do we manifest our beliefs into a physical condition? That's the key mystery. Many doctors would cling to an entirely physical explanation, pointing to changes in the immune system or the brain. But those changes in our physiology are the evidence of what the body-mind is doing. Once you start dealing with beliefs, the elusive word "why" cannot be avoided. For example, it is well documented that traumatic psychological events like being fired or losing a loved one lower a person's immune response. It has also been shown that the brain by itself can stubbornly believe in a falsehood. This is what happens in the phenomenon known as phantom limbs, where an arm or leg has been amputated, but the patient continues to feel the shape of the missing limb. This phantom is often accompanied by pain and discomfort. Even though the mind knows the truth, the brain is holding on to the physical equivalent of a belief. Quite often, when our bodies do something we don't like, why becomes more personal. Why is this happening to me? No answer that depends on purely physical causes is dependable. Even in simple, everyday cases, a whole system approach is needed. In the winter, for example, catching a cold isn't just a matter of being exposed to the cold virus, rhinovirus. Some people have emotional immunity that protects them even if you give them a pure dose of rhinovirus directly into their noses. That's exactly what a team from Carnegie Mellon University and the University of Pittsburgh did with 276 adult subjects. The virus entered the bloodstream and infected almost everyone. But only a certain percentage actually developed cold symptoms. Why? The researchers thought that the difference was created by relationships. This turned out to be right. And not just that, the effect could be quantified. Subjects were asked about how many social relationships they had, ranging from family and friends to clubs, schoolmates, church, and volunteer work. A total of 12 categories. 1 point was assigned for each relationship in which the subject made contact, either in person or by phone, at least once in 2 weeks, so the maximum score was 12. The key finding was that people who reported only 1 to 3 kinds of relationships were 4 times more likely to exhibit cold symptoms than those who reported 6 or more kinds of relationships. It wouldn't seem all that surprising if someone with a loving mother who supplied sympathy and chicken soup had greater immunity than a lonely widower. But this study proved a bit baffling because it was the number and diversity of relationships that counted, not their level of intimacy. Being embedded in a wide social network created emotional immunity, even when physical risk factors like smoking, antibodies, exercise, and sleep were accounted for. As before, finding evidence of a body-mind phenomenon isn't difficult. It's the why, which originates in the mind, that needs to be unraveled. The best place to begin is with the placebo effect, a term almost everyone is familiar with, but one that has yet to be explained, despite years of trying. being your own placebo. Medical advances depend on knowing reliably what works and what doesn't. No one wants to take an ineffective drug or supplement. Perhaps you're considering an over-the-counter homeopathic product. Will it work for you? Is it acceptable if it works for only a percentage of people? These are basic questions, but there is an X factor to consider. If you take the homeopathic and feel better from it, maybe the physical product isn't actually causing the improvement, but only your belief that it would. The fact is that your beliefs, your conditioning since childhood, and even the genes you inherited from your parents belong to the X factor. The homeopathic or any other drug or supplement only partially determines how you will respond to treatment. The placebo effect, which brings healing totally without an active medical ingredient, is very enticing. If you could be your own placebo, the safest form of healing would be at your disposal. Every cell in your body knows exactly what it needs and takes nothing else. Could this be true of the body-mind as a whole? If so, we would only need to contact the level of the self that totally supports our cells, consciously offering what they need. Before deciding if that's a realistic possibility, let's look deeper into the whole phenomenon. Among physicians, the placebo effect has been fascinating, confusing, and frustrating at the same time. In practice, few, if any, doctors would dare to treat a patient with a dummy pill in place of the real thing. But in clinical drug trials, the placebo effect must be ruled out, otherwise the efficacy of the drug can't be known. The word placebo means, "I shall please," and was once used in a prayer, "Placebo Domino," means, "I shall please the Lord." The religious association survives even today because some of the placebo effect comes from the ritual of receiving a medication at the hands of a white-coated physician in the environment of his office or the hospital. It wasn't until the 18th century that the term placebo was used to mean a decoy drug. In modern medicine, a pioneering American anesthesiologist, Henry Knowles Beecher, carried out some of the earliest studies of the placebo effect in the 1950s. Beecher had served on the front as a doctor in World War II, where he observed that some severely wounded soldiers apparently felt so little pain that they asked for no painkillers. Based later at Harvard and Massachusetts General Hospital, Beecher put forward in a seminal 1955 paper that the perception of pain isn't always dependent on the severity of an injury or illness. Today, this principle is widely accepted. We know that the only reliable way to measure the level of pain is by asking the patient to rate his own pain. What seems like a 10 to 1 person on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is excruciating pain, will be rated a 7 or even lower by another patient. Beecher asked whether the perception of pain can be influenced by someone's beliefs and expectations surrounding a placebo drug. He went on to conduct a series of clinical studies to test his hypothesis, eventually concluding that in roughly 35% of successful treatments, the placebo effect was at work. This finding rocked the medical world at the time, and the shock waves only spread wider in the coming decades. In later studies, it was found that the placebo effect was even more prevalent, accounting for up to 60% of therapeutic effects. For example, in a study of leading antidepressants, chemically known as fluoxetine, sertraline, and paroxetine, 50% of the positive outcomes were due to the placebo effect and only 27% to the drugs themselves. Beecher's findings also had indirect effects on the medical profession. For example, Over the next half century, doctors' attitudes about telling patients the truth changed radically. It had been accepted practice not to inform a patient of a fatal diagnosis for fear that the news would do more harm than good. When Emperor Hirohito of Japan was diagnosed with intestinal cancer in September 1987, he wasn't told by the court physician and had no idea of his condition up to his death in January 1989, more than a year later. We live in an era of truth-telling today, and every patient expects as a matter of course to be told their diagnosis. But the other side of the placebo effect, the nocebo effect, is also real. The belief that things are going to turn out badly exerts its own powerful influence. The nocebo effect can be self-induced. In a 2017 study of over 1,300 patients who had been diagnosed with non-celiac gluten sensitivity, 40% turned out to have no actual sensitivity to gluten when tested in a blind clinical trial. That is, the patients didn't know whether they were receiving actual gluten or not. In only 16% of the cases were gluten-sensitive symptoms found, despite previous diagnostic testing. It was concluded that the 40% with no symptoms after receiving gluten may have experienced the nocebo effect in everyday life when they showed symptoms. A strange and fatal form of the nocebo effect occurred in an epidemic of people dying in their sleep in the 1980s. In this case, dozens of Southeast Asian immigrants, men in their early 30s, began dying always in their sleep, thousands of miles away from their homeland. This mysterious occurrence centered on males of the Hmong people, also known as the Hmong, a mountainous tribe spread from Laos to China. Here, they also had in common that they originally came from Laos. This medical mystery acquired the name of Sudden Unexpected Nocturnal Death Syndrome, SUNS. Interviews would later reveal that the Hmong men were being killed by their belief in the spirit world. They were dying in their sleep of heart attacks while they were being literally scared to death, as survivors reported the experience. The common feature medically was sleep paralysis, a harmless natural occurrence that happens to everyone in deep sleep, in which the limbs become immobile. But here, the paralysis was part of a lucid or waking dream in which the dreamer believes he's no longer asleep and finds to his horror that he's paralyzed. Sleep paralysis has long been associated with nocturnal evil in many cultures. In Indonesia, it's called digunton, to press on. In China, beigweya, held by a ghost. The word nightmare is derived from the Dutch nachtmerrie, in which the mare is a female supernatural being who lies on dreamers' chests and suffocates them. In many parts of the West, it's called old hag syndrome. The terror of being unable to move, combined with the pre-existing cultural belief that the state involves an evil being, was enough to induce cardiac arrest among the Hmong men. Because a placebo is a two-edged sword, various issues arise. For instance, can a placebo wind up having the reverse effect, actually harming the patient? Consider one study that pushed the envelope on the efficacy of antidepressants, suggesting that up to 75% of success in treating depression was due to the placebo effect. The public has reacted badly to the headline, "Antidepressants Don't Work," because it undermines their faith in a pill they wish worked. Being told that they were in essence duped left many feeling alone, isolated, and helpless in the face of their depression. But drug dependency has remained at high levels for this disorder. Prozac Nation wasn't prepared to turn into Placebo Nation, and it didn't. The market for the most popular antidepressants has only increased. Moreover, you don't even need a pill to create a placebo effect. When patients with irritable bowel syndrome underwent a sham acupuncture treatment in which the needles never actually penetrated the skin, the researchers found that a striking 44% of subjects reported improvement of their symptoms, including the digestive problems and pain associated with irritable bowel. Moreover, when the sham procedure was combined with positive reinforcement and encouragement from the acupuncturist, fully 62% of subjects reported improvement. For a long time, explaining the placebo effect was like entering a black box, a scientist's term for a phenomenon that doesn't connect cause and effect. Here, no one knew what happened between administering the placebo and later observing its effect or lack of effect. Medicine was hampered by an apples and oranges mentality because the physical nature of a sugar pill, the apple, didn't match the psychological nature of whatever the pill was doing, the orange. With a whole system approach, we aren't saddled with this dilemma because there is no black box. The placebo effect works because it crosses the artificial boundary between mind and body. Here's a diagram to describe what happens. Placebo influences interpretation, influences outcome. Nothing truly foreign is occurring in the placebo effect. Quite the opposite. Any experience you have undergoes interpretation before it has any effect. In a classic placebo experiment, patients suffering from chronic nausea were given a drug they were told would make their nausea go away. And in around 30% of cases, this happened. What they weren't told was that the drug in question actually causes nausea. So the power of interpretation went beyond sugar pills that improved symptoms despite the pill's innocuousness. Now, experimenters saw improvements despite the physical action of the drug. As shocking as Beecher's original findings were, this new wrinkle has yet to impact the medical profession as much as it should. There's no need to unfold a litany of the numerous placebo-nocebo trials that together reach the same conclusion. But to underline how indisputable the effect is, we want to show how blanket the effect is. It extends beyond sham drugs to procedures as drastic as sham surgery, and the whole system is potentially subject to the placebo effect, far beyond the initial observations about pain. Here are some research highlights. In a 2009 trial, patients were treated to alleviate the pain due to osteoporosis. The procedure consisted of repairing damaged vertebrae with injections of bone cement. The placebo group didn't receive the injection. Instead, the doctor put pressure on their spines while allowing them to smell the medical cement. Both groups reported the same level of pain relief. In the end, the placebo results helped to invalidate the efficacy of the actual procedure, since shown to be effective, it would have to outperform a sham procedure. This still begs the question of how valuable it might be to relieve pain strictly by relying on the placebo effect. But what if those on placebo also benefited simply based on their belief in the promise of the treatment? In his career as a leading Alzheimer's researcher, Rudy has tracked the disease at the genetic level to discover how to combat the senile plaques that litter the brains of Alzheimer's patients and destroy nerve cells. He actively participates in the urgent mission to develop drugs to stop the buildup of these plaques. A small trial was conducted on a promising new medicine developed in Australia called PBT2, which was aimed at clearing existing plaque away. As a placebo, subjects were given an inert red pill, and plaque levels were assessed before and after the treatment using brain imaging. Subjects given the PBT2 did show less plaque on average after taking the drug, but so did the placebo group, to a lesser extent. Unfortunately, this was enough to rule the trial drug a failure. In the larger picture, however, it's remarkable that a placebo can lead to an actual physiological change, not simply a patient's subjective sense of reduced pain and discomfort. If belief and expectation can alter the brain, how far does their power extend? Because belief is so crucial in the placebo effect, it would seem that deception is necessary in order to trigger a patient's trust in the actual drug he might be taking. But Ted Kapchuk, a leading placebo researcher at Harvard, is investigating the possibility of doing away with the element of deception. He tells patients upfront that they will be taking a placebo, but he also informs them about how powerful and effective placebos can be. In one trial with irritable bowel syndrome, it was found that roughly 59% of those on an open placebo treatment reported improvements as compared with 35% of the control group that received no treatment. The results may seem modest, but they make the point that giving a placebo isn't the same as doing nothing, a lingering prejudice that still exists in some medical quarters. How to change your interpretation. Although the actual cause of the placebo effect is unknown, there is no doubt about the crucial role played by belief, expectation, and perception. As far back as 1949, the pioneering researcher Stuart Wolf proposed that the placebo effect was greatly influenced by personal perception, writing that the mechanisms of the body are capable of reacting not only to direct physical and chemical stimulation, but also to symbolic stimuli, words and events which have somehow acquired special meaning for the individual. We generally don't think that symbols shape our sense of reality, much less shape our bodies. But when you were sick in bed as a child, by taking a small white pill with the expectation of getting better, you entered the world of symbols. The contents of the pill were unknown to you, but it symbolically stood for getting well, and more symbols began to draw a map in your head. Pause for a moment and see if you agree or disagree with the following statements about doctors. Agree, disagree. If you want to stay well, keep away from doctors. Agree, disagree. Healthcare costs will never go down if doctors have anything to do with it. Agree, disagree. Doctors ask us to trust them, but that's hard when one medical study says A and the next study says the opposite of A. Agree, disagree. Doctors are in the pockets of the big drug companies. Agree, disagree. Most doctors want to get you out of their office as fast as possible. Rationally speaking, each of these statements can be fact-checked, but most people will immediately agree or disagree based on other criteria. Their good or bad experience with medical care, stories they get from the media, biases acquired from friends and family, good or bad feelings toward upper-income earners, and so on. We rarely bother to untangle our personal reasons for making snap judgments, and yet we also don't want to back down when facts are actually brought to bear. Those negative statements about doctors turn them into symbols of bad personal traits: greed, incompetence, selfishness, callousness, and even outright dishonesty. Symbols are so powerful that the rational mind has a difficult time laying them to rest. Compared with the certainty and simplicity of a snap judgment, the counter-arguments against those same negative statements are boring and cautious. For example, not all doctors fit a blanket description. It would take statistical studies to verify how many doctors actually do exhibit these bad traits. Such studies are likely to be unreliable because judgments are so subjective. For each bad thing a doctor is accused of doing, he deserves to tell his side of the story. We could have presented a set of positive statements instead that turn doctors into positive symbols of professionalism, education, caring, dedication, compassion, and selflessness. An unscrupulous Medicare cheater committing fraud in a Florida pill mill symbolizes something very different from a member of Doctors Without Borders combating an Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Depending on how you have responded since childhood, these symbols have become ingrained inside you as belief, habit, conditioning, fears, and preconceived notions. All exist on a sliding scale between very positive and very negative. Therefore, placebo, nocebo extend far beyond the usual definition. No one can say with authority how a symbol, seemingly so abstract and impalpable a thing, can create changes in the physiology. But our discussion of the placebo effect leaves no doubt about the fact that personal experiences get metabolized as much as food, air, and water get metabolized. In theory, you could follow every molecule in a bit of broccoli to see where it wound up in the body, but that's not true of an experience, because the mind-body links are invisible to begin with and only trigger physical effects at a later stage of chemical reaction. Aaliyah Crum, a Stanford psychologist who led a 2017 study calling for more research into the non-physical aspect of healing, encapsulates the issues perfectly. "We have long been mystified by the placebo effect," she says. "But the placebo effect isn't some mysterious response to a sugar pill. It is the robust and measurable effect of three components: the body's natural ability to heal, the patient mindset, and the social context. When we start to see the placebo effect for what it really is, we can stop discounting it as medically superfluous and can work to deliberately harness its underlying components to improve healthcare. Being your own placebo, obviously, would be impossible if you had to fool yourself. Kapchuk's tactic of eliminating the element of deception opens the door to a different approach. But even here, the symbolic effect of a physician telling you that a placebo can be powerful medicine counts for something. Telling yourself that you might get relief from a migraine headache or lower back pain by taking a sugar pill isn't viable. You might as well dispense with the pill and drink a glass of water. But you can activate the placebo effect by instilling the one thing that triggers it: a positive belief in being healed. The qualities of a healing belief. It must be convincing enough to inspire confidence. It must dispel a negative belief. It must have personal meaning for you. It has to bring positive results. It must be reliable and repeatable in its effects. Each of these criteria is realistic and non-mystical, although some would argue that the potent effects of phenomena like faith healing, psychic healing, and indigenous cults like voodoo are entangled with everything on the list. Taking no position on faith healing, we endorse the power of having faith in yourself. That's where control of the healing response comes from. But there are many levels of confidence a belief can instill. Hearing a friend say, "I'm sure you'll get better," has very little effect compared to having a highly respected physician tell you the same thing. Yet nothing is as powerful as building your own belief system and, more important, knowing that everyone's belief system is dynamic and can change on a dime. Imagine that you're going to a party at the invitation of a friend, and knowing nothing about what to expect, you ask on the way to the party, "Who is going to be there?" Your friend might reply, "Just some boring people from the office." "The Broadway cast from Hamilton?" a group of civil rights activists. Some convicts who just got out of prison and want a fresh start. These responses will have wildly different effects on your belief that you will enjoy the party or not. They trigger everything we've been talking about with the placebo effect, including expectation, perception, outcome, and symbols. We gather them together under the heading of interpretation, the process that turns the data of an experience into an actual experience. Interpretation can be thought of as a series of filters. When you set eyes on something, hear words, or confront an everyday situation, your filters ask, "Do I want this experience, or should I shut it out? How much of this is going to feel good? How much is going to feel bad? Have I been here before? If so, how did I react? Is this something that needs my attention right now? Do I need to say or do something? Do I even care?" Once you are conscious of the process of interpretation, you can change any aspect of it. At the opposite extreme, you can react mindlessly with the default response, like a child who hates spinach no matter how much coaxing our parents do. The point in this chapter is that your cells are listening to your interpretation and respond to it as their own experience. "I hate spinach" can trigger a gag reflex or pretending to have one. And by association, the parent's blood pressure could go up. So let's accept that your beliefs and all the other elements of interpretation are activating bodily responses all the time. It's your conscious choice to make any situation a healing one, beginning with your choice of beliefs. The most healing beliefs would include, "I expect to be happy and well. I'm in control. Whatever needs to be faced, I'm up to the challenge. I feel safe and unafraid. I'm supported by family and friends. I am loved, and I love in return. I accept who I am." Notice that only the first belief, "I expect to be happy and well," touches upon health and then only by implication. The other beliefs pertain to how you relate to yourself. The main point of this book is that everything comes down to the self. In large part, your self is a system of beliefs. A belief isn't like a coat you can put on or take off. It's more like a piece of invisible genetic code that has helped to create you as a person. Among the beliefs that hinder healing, almost all are simply the reverse of a healing belief. "I expect to be unhappy and get sick more often than most people. I'm not in control of my life. A lot depends on people and circumstances beyond my control. Many challenges would be too hard to bear. I'm subject to anxiety and worry about the bad things that could happen to me. I'm pretty much alone and have to look after myself without support from others. I don't have much love in my life. I judge against myself." We realize that, on both the positive and negative sides of the equation, these statements aren't couched in the form, "I believe X." But peel away the sentiment being expressed, and even something that looks like a statement of fact, "I accept who I am," or "I'm subject to anxiety," can be traced to a belief that is being masked. "I'm subject to anxiety," for example, could mask any manner of belief such as, "The world isn't a safe place. It only makes sense to be afraid. Fear keeps me vigilant and alert." Or, "I was made this way," to give just some leading possibilities. The process of transforming your beliefs in the direction of healing isn't mysterious. It just breaks down negative beliefs step by step. 1. When you catch yourself saying anything that's negative, ask, "Is this really true?" Exposing an automatic reflex to rational questioning is an important step in letting go of it. 2. When you start to examine a negative belief that has come up, ask, is this really helping me? 3. Be detached from the negative beliefs of others. Secondhand infection happens frequently. 4. For every negative belief you expose, offer yourself 2 positive beliefs. 5. Journal about your journey of self-exploration. Write down any changes in your belief system that you see are happening, or simply that you want to happen. 6. Spend more time with supportive, loving, inspiring, and generally positive people. Avoid the opposite kind of people. 7. Value the whole project of self-care and increasing your state of well-being. We want to particularly reinforce step 4. For every negative belief you expose, offer yourself 2 positive beliefs. This is a powerful way to become the creator of your own belief system. If you don't, you will passively accept all kinds of secondhand, unproven beliefs that will continue to be in charge. Try creating new beliefs by writing them down and take the time to choose beliefs you have some confidence in, not random or abstract possibilities. For example, negative belief. I can foresee the worst-case scenario, and it's bound to come true. New beliefs. I can't really see the future. Dwelling on the worst-case scenario doesn't help me. If I am open to other possibilities, I'm more likely to find a better outcome. A lot of times, I thought the worst-case scenario would play out, and then it didn't. Negative belief. I'm no good in a crisis. New beliefs. Asking for help doesn't mean I'm weak. I can learn how to deal with this crisis by consulting someone who has survived the same thing. No one says I have to do this alone. I've survived a lot so far. A crisis can also be an opportunity. There's a solution to every problem if you look deep enough. Even though each of these beliefs, whether negative or not, isn't the same as a statement of fact, it has the magical property of turning into a self-fulfilling prophecy. Reality goes where belief leads. How? For a group of medical researchers, the question may come down to genetics, which can strongly influence one's predisposition to the placebo-nocebo effect. Predicting who is more likely to benefit from a placebo is potentially very important for clinical trials of new drugs. In the search for genetic links, a set of genes has already been termed the placebome, in keeping with the term genome, and more recent offshoots like microbiome. The identification and characterization of the placebome is still in the earliest stages, but some compelling clues have already come to light. Genes involved with the brain neurochemical dopamine, which is associated with risk-taking and reward, as well as other genes involved with opiates, pain relief, and even cannabinoids, molecules produced by the brain that are analogs of the active ingredients in marijuana, have been implicated. Given the whole system nature of the placebo effect, a complex web of processes is very likely at work, going all the way to the level of our genes. No one knows where the genetic trail might lead. In the meantime, for anyone leading a healing lifestyle, negative beliefs must be exposed to light before change is possible. It's fascinating to discover that the words we apply to our sense of being conscious, like alert, vigilant, self-aware, and awake, also apply to ourselves. As we'll see in the next chapter, the healer's role is much easier to adopt once you realize that you are just expanding one of nature's greatest gifts, the wisdom of the body. 9. The wise healer. It's a major step to realize that body and mind should be considered the body-mind, thus curing the state of separation. But we can go a step further and reach a deeper level of healing. Not only deeper, but easier and more natural. This step involves the wisdom of the body, which too many people ignore or don't believe in. If your body and mind were law partners, they'd hang out a shingle with Mind Esquire first, because the general consensus says that the mind deserves to be the senior partner. In contrast, the body supposedly understands nothing. The image in the book of Genesis of God creating Adam out of a lump of clay has had a far-reaching impact, even though the lumps are now clumps of cells. Pause for a moment to answer the following questions. Which is smarter, the body or the mind? Which is more creative? Which is wiser? Which are you prouder of right now? If you think more highly, right this minute, of your mind than your body, anyone past the age of 50 will sympathize, then you have bought into old beliefs that need revising. The intelligence of the body is millions of years older and far deeper than the rational mind. The body deserves to be equal in the body-mind partnership. The practical result of this realization is to become a wise healer. Control by the host. The wisdom of the body exists everywhere. Scientists and lay people alike have developed the habit of exalting the brain as the only place where intelligence resides. By now, having seen how the body's information superhighway works, you know that messaging is a constant process that involves all 50 trillion cells. But this doesn't dispel the worshipful regard that has been directed at the brain. After all, can a liver cell compose Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? Can a kidney cell understand E equals MC squared? Actually, the body performs feats of intelligence that leave those two examples in the dust. Since our topic is healing, let's look at the central player in protecting the body from harm, the immune system. In medicine, we talk about control by the host, which means that after a disease organism, pathogen, enters the body, only a certain percentage of people will become infected, and only another percentage will exhibit symptoms. The reason that everyone doesn't get sick is that the body runs a multi-layered defense to control everything happening inside us. Control by the host is a natural phenomenon that begins with a series of physical defenses dating back tens of millions of years. An open wound exposed to the air puts you at high risk for invading pathogens. Yet if you stop and think, your lungs are just as exposed and open to the air as an open wound. The difference is that the respiratory system is lined with mucus, which catches invading dust and germs like flypaper. In addition, each breath you take must follow a long, convoluted path before reaching the delicate membranes where oxygen is exchanged with carbon dioxide, and all these byways block or trap more invaders. The skull and spinal vertebrae are formidable defensive walls, because few pathogens can make it through bone. Your skin is a much softer barrier, but it is more defensive than you might think. The dryness of the skin surface and the salt left behind from sweating make a poor environment for pathogens to multiply in. Where the skin has natural openings, there are other defensive measures, like the flow of tears that drain debris from the eyes and the acidity of vaginal secretions. Tears, saliva, and nasal secretions contain lysozyme, an enzyme that breaks down the cell walls of bacteria. Inevitably, this first line of defense proves inadequate, because the same process of evolution that creates defense mechanisms also creates invaders better equipped to get past them. When a pathogen makes it inside the body, usually as a bacterium or virus,